welcome to the Grant Hill Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pedramont. I'm here with author Laura Nelson. And, Laura, why don't we hear from you a bit about your background, education, professional, whatnot?
So in my day job, I am a librarian. That is my 9-to-5. Very much a history nerd. And libraries have been sort of the place where I've always enjoyed being, bookworm, all that kind of stuff. And so...
How did I miss that you're a librarian? Sorry to interrupt. I'm trying to let you talk. And I'm gonna let you finish, but no, actually on Facebook the other day, I saw somebody talking and he was giving his analysis from a librarian's perspective. And I was like, awesome. You know, hey, and I invited him on the podcast. So I'll have a librarian on the podcast in January.
Come on. Well, you have a librarian on the podcast right now.
Maybe we didn't set a date yet. Anyway, January, February, we'll have him on, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But we have you on and we want to talk about your work today, right?
Yeah.
So your background, you're a librarian. And so did you go to college with that intent?
My education intent kind of evolved over the years. When I started, I was like, I'm going to be a teacher because I love teaching. I still love teaching, but I realized that teaching comes in a whole bunch of different ways. Like, you don't necessarily have to be in a classroom to be a teacher. And so I went to college and I was like, I'm going to be a teacher. And I took one education class and I'm just like, this is going to drive me nuts. I was not a fan of the education program. And so at that same time, I got a job as a student worker in my college's special collections department. So that is basically where we keep all the old precious materials. We have collections from like people who were... So I went to school at Southern Utah University. Mm-hmm. And so we had collections of famous people in Utah history, that kind of stuff. And so when I started working there, first it was just supposed to be a job to get me through school. And then I realized I really like working in libraries and I really like working with historical materials, which the historical materials part didn't surprise me. I'm absolutely 100% a history nerd. But then I was like, as I was going through school, I was like, okay, well, maybe I won't go into teaching. Instead, I will go be a librarian. And I started researching that. And long story short, I ended up applying to and getting an internship at the Smithsonian my senior year. That was a lot of fun because that was spring of 2009. And so there was a lot going on in DC at that point. And I ended up interning at the National Museum of American History. And through like meeting people out there, I found out about the Archival, the Masters of Library Science program at the University of Maryland. So that's where I ended up going to grad school. And when I was there, I was like, yeah, I'm going to be a librarian and I'm going to be, you know, writing all these papers and publishing and being like this awesome librarian. And then I graduated. And that was when, that was like 2012. And, the economy was like, no, we don't need any more librarians. And so I did get a library job, but it took a while. And it wasn't necessarily this epic library job that I thought it would be, but it paid the bills. And I'm still technically in that job. That is my day job. But I was able to move from doing metadata and acquiring books to actually being in their special collections department. So it kind of became full circle, but that was my very long non-linear way to where I am now.
Where are you? What library are you at?
I am at Cal State San Marcos.
Okay. Okay.
So I'm in an academic library, working on, we have a whole bunch of different collections. The one that I work on is a local history collection. There was a photographer who worked for one of the local newspapers. And so I want to say he photographed probably about 40 years worth of development in the San Diego area. And we now have his collection and we're making that accessible to everyone.
Yeah.
But yeah, history.
I was probably about half an hour away from that. Because I mentioned before we started recording that I was in California. I was at Camp Pendleton and we lived in Oceanside. Before, so we kind of did a phased move the last time we moved to California. And I went out there and I rented a room for a few months, and then I came back, and because we were in Virginia at that time, so I came back to Virginia and brought my family out after a few months. But I rented that room in San Marcos, and moving away from it, I mean, it was nice to get out of that room because the landlady, let's say that she had an issue with my choice of what day I was moving out because it was her birthday. I'm like,
Oh
what
dear.
does this have to do with you? I have this going on. I have this going on. It has to be that day. Like maybe I can move some things earlier, but I can't guarantee it. And it doesn't involve you. I'll just be doing my thing. Anyway, so it was good to leave that behind, but I moved farther away from Freddy's. And do you ever go to Freddy's?
I've been there a few times. It's
I've
not
been there
my
a few
absolute
times.
favorite, but they've got some amazing shakes.
Yeah,
So it's
I do like those burgers. That I think they're good.
I
But
thought they're kind of flat.
they are
That
flat.
was Freddy's thing, is like the flat burgers.
Yeah.
And
I didn't
so
understand at first what they meant by steak burgers, but I get it now. It's because they grind up steak instead of the normal cut or chuck or whatever. But yeah, I thought the flavor was great, and I like a lot of veggies on my burgers, which was something that Freddy's does well.
I'm trying to remember whether or not we had a conversation over In-N-Out versus Five Guys.
I don't think so. I think we didn't talk very long at 20 books. For the podcast audience, this is we met at 20 Books Vegas in early November, so maybe we did.
I don't know.
So
I feel like though, maybe I'm remembering a conversation with someone else, but yeah, I usually with people who I know who have, because I grew up in Virginia, who both been on the East Coast and the West Coast. When it comes to burgers, the debate is usually Five Guys or In-N-Out.
Well, and I grew up in Texas, so it's like my duty to throw Whataburger in there. And I have to say, I don't know. You get different hankerings at different times, and I wouldn't know to compare Five Guys and In-N-Out. I haven't had Five Guys as many times because it's expensive.
But they
It's
give you
10
more
bucks for a
stuff.
burger. Yeah, and it's a bigger burger. So I like just talking flavor. I don't know. It's kind of hard for me to compare because I don't put them in the same category because Five Guys is just expensive.
I will say that, like, talking about
But I think I put Freddy's above them. I do
I
like
might have to go
Freddy's.
check out Freddy's again. Because it has been a while. It's been about 4 years since I moved from San Marcos.
I might be biased towards Freddy's because I took advantage of a Veterans Day deal, and I had Freddy's the day in the afternoon after I ran an ultra marathon.
Oh,
So
okay.
I wanted every single calorie. I wanted all that salt, and it was really delicious. Yeah.
But no, that the reason I brought up Five Guys and In-N-Out is because Five Guys tends to have a lot more vegetables that you can put on your burgers than
Yeah.
In-N-Out does. So
I do feel like In-N-Out tastes fresher, though.
I think, well, the burgers, yes, I would agree with that. The fries, I've never been a fan of In-N-Out fries.
Okay.
I feel like they're kind of...
I can see that. They're distinct.
Yeah.
So,
whereas, like, with Five Guys, their potatoes, you know where their potatoes come from. You know the farm that their potato was raised on.
Mm. I put Freddy's on top. I'm discovering this about myself. I didn't know I was such a big fan of Freddy's. And I am glad to know that I'm half an hour away from Freddy's here. I don't know if they were there before, but they're there now, down in Fredericksburg.
Okay.
I'm sad that they're half an hour away instead of closer. You mentioned, I'm sorry, I didn't grab, what exactly was your bachelor's in?
History.
History. Okay.
I got, my major was history and my minor, was, English, creative writing, surprisingly.
Okay.
Actually not so surprisingly since I'm an author now. That actually is another fun story. Cause I've always loved to write, since I was a little kid. I wrote my first, like, I guess it would be considered a novella when I was like 12. And when I was in high school, we had a creative writing class. I was like, yeah, I want to take that. And my mother was absolutely against it. She was like, writers, authors don't make money. So you need to have a practical skill set. And so I ended up taking teacher education courses in high school. And that was kind of what got me into, I'll be a teacher when, you know, when I grow up.
But if you could have seen the future, and then what? You would have, if you could have seen the future, you'd have just cranked out the stories, and then 2011 and KDP, and you just
exactly.
Start, boom, 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 you'd be a millionaire now.
Exactly. But unfortunately, I couldn't see the future. I'm not psychic. But what I did do was when I went to college, especially after I realized that I was not going to get my degree in an education license, I switched my minor to English creative writing and took all of the creative writing courses I could take, both because I was like, I want to learn as much as I can, but also to kind of maybe prove to my mother that, you know, I could take writing classes. I don't want to say be spiteful, but I was like, this is what I want to do. This is what I enjoy. And I will say that I learned some things from those classes, but it was more like literary stuff. You know, what are the different elements in Gothic literature, that kind of stuff. What do the famous authors do? And I mean, it's somewhat helpful, but on the other hand, it wasn't as helpful if you're going to become a published author yourself. Mm. So.
Yeah.
But I that's that. Or go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think it's interesting how so many people go to college for one thing and either switch majors and do something else, or they take their degree and then go and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I was obstinate. So I did complete my degree as originally intended. In music education.
What instrument?
I was a little on the fence between music ed and computer science, but I decided music ed would probably be more fulfilling. And I'm really glad I did that. But I remember there was at the local music store in Orem, Utah, because I was at Brigham Young University.
Go Cougars.
Yeah.
I had family that went to BYU, so.
There was, yeah. So at the local music store, there was somebody there who, he had a music ed degree, but he figured that this was where he, like, his role ultimately was in, you could say, the supporting establishment, and I'm taking that vocabulary from the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked at the music store, because that's important. Music programs need instruments, they need music repair.
Exactly, yeah.
It's an important part of the community.
Yeah. I was curious what instrument you took because my husband also went to BYU, but he went to BYU Idaho before it was BYU Idaho.
Okay.
And
Well, I
so,
took the clarinet.
okay. He was a French horn person,
Okay.
so, but he
Or
had a kind of a similar, he went in.
that's a buffet. It was made in France, and
Oh,
it's,
really?
generic word horn is a wind instrument. That is a French horn.
But wait, sorry, say that again.
I'm playing with the terminology.
Okay.
Everybody knows a French horn is a coiled brass instrument. If you want to get technical, it has a conical bore. But like generic terms, horn, like a clarinet is a horn, not a brass horn, but it's a woodwind. It's a horn, and that's a buffet, with and it was made in France. It's a
Okay.
horn. Furthermore, there's the French clarinet and there's the German clarinet. This obviously is the French clarinet, so it's a French horn. So sorry,
That's awesome.
I hijacked you.
Okay.
You said
As you can
you're.
tell, I'm not a music person. I enjoy listening to music, but I'm absolutely like you and my husband would probably have some good conversations. Because it seems like you guys have two very similar backgrounds.
Okay, cool.
No, but I love that. I love that factoid, and that's probably something that it'll stick in my brain. And who knows, it might end up in some of my writing. I was actually working on one of my characters for my new series, and she is because she's one of the muses. I have her as a flautist. And so I was having to like look up all of those like terminology stuff. And I'm just like, I have no idea what I'm like, I need to do more research.
I do want to get to our topic, but first I have to say, 'cause you're in San Marcos. Do you live in San Marcos or where do you?
Not anymore. I'm up north in Riverside.
Okay.
So
Just
it's too expensive to live in San Diego anymore.
Yeah. Make good use of your hiking trails because you have
Oh
some great
yes.
trails out there.
We've
And
got some good ones like literally outside our neighborhood.
oh, good.
So.
Good for you. I did a couple of hikes. Do you know Iron Mountain? There's Iron Mountain and then there's Mount Woodson, Potato Chip Rock.
Okay. I have not been. I Iron Mountain sounds familiar. I have not been to the other one.
Yeah. And yeah, there's some great trails in San Diego County. But when we lived in Oceanside, we lived right next to the San Luis Rey River, and there was a trail, the San Luis Rey River Trail. And it was a 5 minute walk away. And depending where you were on it felt more urban. A lot of it was things were far enough away, so you felt you were in nature.
Yeah, that's kind of the cool thing with certain parts of northern San Diego County is that you can go from places that are very urban to places that there's like nothing. And that's starting to get a little less so because people are, they're building and everything. But yeah, it's still there's still some very beautiful places.
Well, and our specific neighborhood that we were in, just like right around behind the community, there was a park called Libby Lake Park. There was a pond called Libby Lake. And my son, who is 4 now, was 2 when we, I guess most of the time that we lived in that neighborhood, he missed it. He was 3 when we moved away,
Yeah.
And we moved, and it was kind of a phased move to get from there to here. And so I took the family to Utah because my wife had to take care of her late mother's house. And then I drove back to California and I loaded up the truck and drove across the country. And the family flew across and met us in an Airbnb because the house that we owned out here was currently rented out, and we overlapped with their rental term by a month and a half. And so we get to this Airbnb, we're in somebody's basement, and our poor 3-year-old is like, when are we going home? I want to go to Libby Lake. And our house comes back to us, and now he's, he was 3 he was 2 when we left. Then shortly after, he turned 3. And then we got our house back. And, you know, he's confusing the name of the street and the name of the house and the name of the city. So now we live in Stafford, and that's the city. And he thinks that's the name of the house. But he's like, when are we going home? I want to go to Libby Lake.
Aww.
Like, it was great. Like, we'd go walk around Libby Lake. We'd take pictures of the ducks and the cormorants and the, what are they called? Coots? No, maybe. Maybe there were coots.
Maybe.
And even some herons.
Oh, and nice.
It was great. And then we, in our backyard, we had a few orange trees. We had a couple of lemon trees. It was great. Anyway, so sorry to go off on that tangent. How did you get into writing? So you said you wrote a novella when you were like 12 or?
Kind of. I'm hearing an echo. I don't know if you're hearing that on your side.
Uh-oh, I'm not. It's supposed to be canceling it. Huh. So you're hearing me echo?
I'm hearing myself echo. Okay, now it's gone. Oh. Let's see. If it pops up again, I'll mention it. Okay. So like a lot of kids, I wrote little stories that didn't really, you know, it was just like little one or two page stories. And then, when I was 12, I wrote my first story, which was this, I don't even know if there was a genre. It was a mashup of like historical and fantasy and romance. And it took place in like a magical version of Williamsburg.
Uh-huh.
And it was about as good as you would expect from a 12-year-old. But I thought at 12, I was like, this is brilliant. And I kept writing. I would have different stories that would pop up in my head. And obviously, like, I have a huge hard drive full of these little story prompts and story starts that I have. My dad was always super supportive of my writing. It was like, oh, that's nice. That's great. My mother hated it. So I didn't necessarily get a lot of support that some teenagers do when it comes to like their creative stuff. And so I didn't really do too much.
We have to make rules against our 12-year-old reading. Like, you
really
better not be reading. Yes, because it gets in the way of life. Like, oh, you're reading. You need to brush your hair. You were supposed to feed the cat. Stop. We have specific rules about when she is allowed to read.
I was actually that kid. Like, my parents.
And we love that she reads, and we love that she loves to read. She just does it when she's not supposed to, when she needs to be doing something else.
Yeah.
My
parents would get upset at me because if I got grounded, they struggled to like usually people are like, you know, they ground their kids or they send them to the room, and I'm like, okay, cool. All my books are in my room. Like, that's not really a punishment.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I was totally that kid.
That's one aspect of that's good about having a big house. Because we actually had to move again after we got here because our renters had smoked in our house. So we bought a new house. And we're still not settled into this house. Like, what you don't see is the mess all around me. And like these boxes are not going to live there. We're setting up the library in the basement because there's a door to the basement and we can kind of control access.
Oh.
If you're in the basement, you're accessing things. And
yeah,
not all the books will go in the basement. Like we have some bookshelves in the living room around the fireplace and we're, yeah, but.
You have a bookworm on your hands.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I was very much that kid where I was the bookworm who was constantly reading anything and everything, like all that input gave me like story ideas through high school, through college. I'd be in classes trying to focus on something and I feel bored and I just start like, I don't say daydreaming, but yeah, thinking up stories and all that kind of stuff. And so that, you know, there wasn't really a lot of guidance. There was like, this was also, there's a lot of this was before social media became as big as it is now. And so there wasn't really a lot of people I could interact with and talk writing mm-hmm. about. So a lot of the people who were writers who I was interacting with were either, you know, other kids at my high school, other kids at college, sometimes maybe an English professor or two. And, you know, they could give you sort of like, this is the fan fiction I've been writing, or this is what I think good literature is. But there wasn't really, if I was like, hey, this is the kind of stories that I want to write, this is the kind of fantasy that I really enjoy, there wasn't as much of a, I hadn't yet found the community. And so I did the responsible thing and I, you know, got my degree in history and then I went to graduate school and got a degree in library science. And while I was in grad school, that was when I met my husband and he was actually in the military. And so that was a very short time, though, because soon after we got married, the army started downsizing. Mm. And so that ended up sending us from the East Coast to the West Coast. And I had a couple of like odd jobs. I have this knack for reading old letters and old handwriting, because for a while I was like, hey, you know what? I should do genealogy. I should become a genealogist. Mm-hmm. I enjoy working with old documents and reading those, but which has actually been really good for world building, both like in fantasy worlds and in like historical fiction. But unfortunately, being a genealogist, you do deal with a lot of cranky people who are like, this is what my family has said our story is. And you're like, no. No, I'm sorry. What your great Aunt Betty said was not correct.
Mm.
We have paperwork to prove it. And I was just like, you know.
You probably misremembered. Like that happens all the time.
Exactly. And so I was like, working my day job as a librarian. And then I want to say in 2019, I saw a friend of mine from college on Facebook. She posted that she was writing, that she had just published one of her historical fiction novels. And I didn't even know that she was an author or that she was interested in writing. And so I ended up kind of looking into other books that she had published. And I was like, you know what? This is something that I've always wanted to do. And around that same time, I actually found a letter that I'd written to myself when I was 12 years old. And anyone who's listening to this, I'm LDS. When I was 12, I was in the youth program and they had us write letters to our future selves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found this letter from when I was 12 and I was supposed to open it when I was 18. Obviously I didn't. I'm like 30 some odd years old at this point. And I open this letter and I read it and 12-year-old me is so excited. It's like, I've written this story and I want to write this story and da 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 da. And I plan on being a published author by the time I'm 18. And reading that letter actually kind of broke my heart a little bit. Because I was like, I failed 12-year-old me. And this is a passion that I have had for years, for decades at this point, probably at least 20 years. And I'm just like, you know what? My friend who I didn't even know was an author is publishing her own stuff. I was like, why am I not? And so around 2019, that's when I was like, you know what? I'm going to start taking this more seriously.
You just reminded me of this, the other interview I did today.
Mm-hmm.
And that was with editor Kara Espy. And she said this thing that I meant to comment about again later towards the end of the interview. Because she got sick at one point. She was in the mm-hmm. hospital. And because this was on the topic of like, how did you get into editing in her case? Mm-hmm. And she was in the hospital and she started thinking and she's like, my life is not what I want it to be. What do I want it to be? So I, you know, she decided to act on that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a great point for her. And it sounds like you had something similar with this letter.
I did. I
wrote to yourself.
And when I found it, so when I'd found it, I want to say this was right around the time that, so I've been working at my current job, which I'm still there. And while I do enjoy it, it's a day job. It's not my calling. Writing books is my calling. That while I was there, I had been there for, I want to say like 6 years at this point, and I hadn't really moved like job wise. There was no job growth. And my husband and I had just moved to where we live now, which was a good hour away from where we work, because like I said, it's so expensive to live in San Diego that we couldn't afford it. And so that was, I will say 2019 was kind of, I don't want to say a breaking point, but in a way it was, where it was like, okay, we're feeling kind of stuck. And I was kind of stuck in my career as a librarian. I wasn't feeling like maybe being a librarian wasn't exactly where I was supposed to be. Like I said, it's a good day job. I technically work for the state government. But it wasn't, my passion for that job was quickly fading.
Yeah.
And so then when I saw my friend from college who was writing and then found this letter, it was like everything kind of came together. And I was like, you know what? I need to start writing again more seriously than just, you know, a little dabbling here, a little dabbling there. And so I joined up with like, I wouldn't even call it like a book coach or a writer coach. It was like a writing group of people who were doing self-publishing. And that was how I actually found out about 20 Books, the Facebook group. And so I joined it. And that was my goal for 2019, was like, I'm going to publish something. Even if it's not my own, like, even if it isn't my own book, I'm going to get published in something. That way I have some kind of presence on like Amazon or any of the, you know, distributors. And I ended up doing that. I ended up getting to 2 poetry anthologies. Because I had a bunch of poetry that I'd written that was actually pretty decent over the years, and they accepted it. And those anthologies are no longer being published, just because I think that it was a smaller press, but it did what it needed to do, which was I had an author page on Amazon. And so then 2019's gone, 2020 happens. And I'm just like, when everything in 2020 happened, my job ended up being, we were able to go fully virtual for, I want to say, almost 2 years. My department was fully virtual. Which was very nice, because I can do probably the majority of my work from a laptop. And so In 2020, I was like, you know what? My goal this year is to survive and to learn as much about self-publishing as possible and figure out what I want to do in the future. And so that was a year for just learning and growing and also writing. And one of the things that from this writing group that I had been in, I was telling him, I was like, well, I have this story and I have this story and I like these, because I like to read a lot of different genres, fantasy, romance, historical fiction, sci-fi. The only stuff that I don't really read is a lot of like the dark, gritty horror, that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. Otherwise, my tastes are pretty much across the board. And so I had mentioned this idea of, I had binge played Skyrim over the holidays and had a dream about being tossed into the world of Skyrim and having to go on my own adventure. And I was like, when I woke up, I was like, oh, that'd be a cool idea to just kind of play around with. And so I had maybe, you know, a couple of chapters that I'd written. And then one of the people I met, a friend in this writing group was like, oh man, that sounds like lit RPG. You should totally do that. My book is not lit RPG. It technically doesn't hit a lot of the tropes that are in lit RPG.
But it's sort of maybe.
Yeah, it's more in game lit. And really, the first book is probably the most strongly game lit. And then it goes into more of like epic fantasy, which is what I'm more comfortable with. It's more of the background. My Norse fantasy, more of the background is that the characters are familiar with this fantasy world through a video game that was based off of fantasy world.
It sounds like we are segueing into our intended topic, which is great. So just for our listeners, we are finally arriving at our intended topic where, because I knew that she wrote Norse fantasy, and so I suggested we hit on, I'll read all three of these lines. Norse fantasy, what does that look like? Historical fantasy, what exactly is that? And the differences between world building for those two subgenres. So
back in 2020 was when I was starting to write this series, and I was having to absolutely cut my teeth on writing in a way that would have made my English teachers cringe, because like I said, they were more literary, and I was having to learn like genres, expectations and tropes and that kind of stuff. But stuff that, you know, when I was in college, they're like, no.
I think as an educator, you feel you feel like the onus is on you to present the cream of what is available. So as a trained band teacher, I would be remiss if I left Holst out of the repertoire that I present to my students. Holst and Persichetti and Fennell, and anyway, so the high school English teachers, they probably feel some onus, and you know, there's some amount of dictated curriculum as well. To teach the classics. And I guess, I don't know. I wonder how many of them actually look down their noses at genre fiction that for the reader is
more. I was thinking more along the lines of my college professors. Like I had, interestingly enough, in high school, I had a couple of teachers who were actually amazing at integrating like the classics with more modern stuff and being like, here, look at the classics, which you think are dry and boring, and look at the modern stuff that you guys like to read, and here's where they overlap, and here's how you can, you know, find similar themes and tropes and that kind of stuff. And but no, I had a couple of English teachers in college who were very much like, this is my, like, this is what I think is proper English. This is what I think is good literary stuff. And you cannot convince me otherwise. And anything else is just plain dross. Those are the people I was like, I didn't really learn too much from. So, but yeah, 2020, I had to really learn more of the less of the literary side of writing and more of the like reader expectation, genre tropes, what people are looking for, what people like trying to find what I like to write mixed with what people like to read, as well as story structure, because that was something none of my teachers ever taught me was story structure. Mm-hmm. And so I was reading all of the craft books that, you know, people mentioned. They're like, you should, you know, go check out this, check out, you know, Fool's Cap, Save the Cat. I'm trying to think what the other one, with like circles. I don't know. There's a lot of different ones. And for me, even though I don't do a hard and strict, Save the Cat method, that was what clicked in my brain because, I was able to see the movies that I was watching during the pandemic. I watched a whole lot of Frozen and a whole lot of like the Marvel series. And I could see the beats that the movies were hitting. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. And then I was also playing a lot of video games because I like I said, Skyrim, Elder Scrolls. And I realized that a lot of these really popular video game series, their quest lines were actually much like story beats. Each little section of a quest was a story beat to bring the plot forward. Because, you know, in video games, they want the person who's playing to keep playing. They don't want to be like, oh, this is boring. Okay, I'm going to go play something else. No, they want you to keep going. And it's the same thing with movies or books. You know, they're wanting you to be entertained enough to keep going to the end. And so, yeah, with Save the Cat, I was able to start seeing that in a lot of the entertainment that I consumed. And then I was like, okay, how can I look at my books in that same way? And I had a lot of beta readers and alpha readers. And I will say the amount of time it took me to write book one was massively longer than it was any of the rest of the books in the series.
For our listeners, Save the Cat, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I have not read the book, but Save the Cat is the idea of having the protagonist do something heroic early in the story.
So Save the Cat is originally screenwriting, a book on screenwriting. And You had this man, Blake Snyder, who he realized that all of the very popular, all the big blockbuster movies had a similar story structure. And a lot of it is based off of the hero's journey or the three-act play, where the first act was you're setting up what's going to happen. And then something happens where the main character cannot go back to what has been the status quo. And so once that catalyst has happened, now the main character has to make a decision. They are forced to make a decision. And of course, they make the decision to do something that moves the plot along.
Because if they didn't, you probably wouldn't be telling the story.
Exactly. And so then between the catalyst and the beginning of Act Two is, you know, the time that they're deciding, okay, what am I going to do? Do I really want to do it? And then, you know, Act Two begins, and that is them doing whatever needs to be done to meet their goal. Because they, at the beginning of Act Two, they now have a goal that they and that they want to do. And that's kind of considered the fun and games part. And that's what a lot of people will have little snippets. I know for me, I'd have scenes that were in the like fun and games area, but I didn't know how to connect them. And then that's also kind of where you get kind of the soggy middle, where the story just keeps going on and on and on, and you can't really, like, the momentum dies down.
Yeah, well, hopefully it doesn't, but
it doesn't, but for
it's challenging.
a lot of first time writers, a lot of new authors, new writers, that was something I struggled with, was getting to the middle of the book and then not knowing what to do next. But then at the midpoint of the story, according to like the Save the Cat, and I'm just doing a very high like overview of it. The midpoint, the main character gets their goal, or they don't. One of their two. But they've gotten to the point where if they've achieved their goal, they realize, oh crap, the goal that I had for the first half of this story is not actually the goal that I want. Something has changed. Or if they don't get their goal, they realize, oh wait, I didn't get my goal, but I really want something else. And then either way, after the midpoint, that's when like bad stuff starts to creep up. The bad bad guys close in. So if the main character gets their goal, then the bad guys start showing up to take whatever they, you know, whatever they've got from them, or to keep them from their new goal. If they didn't reach their goal, but then they realize, oh wait, there's something else I want, you know, and it might be internal bad guys, it might be external bad guys, but there's going to be some kind of conflict that keeps the main character from getting what their new goal is. And they have to rise above from what they were doing. They have to rise above to defeat these new problems. And that will inevitably, you have then the dark night of the soul and all is lost point, which is basically a 180 from the midpoint. So if the main character at the midpoint got what they wanted by dark night of the soul and all is lost, they do not have it anymore. Not only do they not have it, but they have hit rock bottom, and they have to realize, I got to do something different if I'm going to still get my goal. And sometimes they'll be very hopeless and they're like, there's no way that I can reach my goal now. I'm screwed. I'm going to give up. And then usually there's some kind of mentor or some kind of incident that reignites their belief in themselves. And that's what then drives them on to the climax. And the climax is when they achieve or nearly achieve their goal, their new goal, and the bad guys are vanquished, and you know, the main character is now back once again a 180 from what they were at their darkest moment.
So sorry, when was it that you really got into, like, I guess you map out the story beats to make sure that you're hitting the right?
Yes. So that was
that.
I started doing that after I read Save the Cat and started clicking for me. That's when I started, like, in general, started drafting out my stories. I'm very much a plotter now. And so before I write a book, I will draft it out. And I tend to do about 60 scenes in a book. Give or take, depends on what the story wants or what works for the story.
Yeah.
But I usually try and hit about 60 scenes because, for the way that the beats are, I'm like, okay, I can, you know, do a story in about 60 beats, give or take. But that is why now, so, prior to about 2020, a lot of my stuff was pantsing. And this is not to poo-poo anyone who pantses. It's just the way my brain works. I know people who, they cannot plot to save their lives because their brains work and in a way in which pantsing works beautifully for them. Pantsing does not work for me. I need to plot it out because then I don't hit the spot where I'm like, I have no idea what I'm going to do next. And then my story languishes for a year.
You probably see too many possibilities. You're like, how can I possibly choose right now? I need to explore them a little better.
Exactly.
And if I take one without knowing where I'm going, I'm going to get caught up a tree and.
And so what I do now is I tend to know, where is my story starting? What is my character's goal? What are they going to get or not get at the middle of the story? And then what is their ultimate goal? What does winning look like for them? And then what is the end scene going to look like? And once I have those pieces in place, then I can kind of flesh out the rest of the story and figure out, okay, if I start here, how am I going to get here? And what's going to happen in the middle? And how's the character going to grow? How's the plot going to progress? All that kind of stuff. So it actually, I will say, it probably takes me longer to plot out a story now, but then it's faster for me to write the story. So once I have a fully plotted out story, and I mean, there's always elements of like interacting with my characters because they are very much alive inside my head. Once the story's plotted out, and the world and world building, that was the other thing that when I was starting with my Norse fantasy stuff, and I know we're supposed to be talking more about world building. With my Norse fantasy, I had to figure out a lot of like, what is their world going to look like? Like I had, you know, I didn't want to just completely take Skyrim and duplicate it because that would be a whole lot of problems. And so instead I was like, okay, what story elements do I like from Skyrim? What elements from like real Norse history do I like? And what just general fantasy, epic fantasy elements do I like? And how do I think my characters are going to interact? Why are they going to interact this way? Why are they going to do what they're going to do? But I will say that world building for my Norse fantasy has took a significant amount of my research time.
So I'm looking at the clock, and before we dive into our intended topic, I don't want to have an episode that's like too long, and we want to release before your book release on the 26th.
Yes.
I had you slated for actually Christmas Day to release the episode. But I want listeners to be able to hear about Norse fantasy as a topic and to really discuss your book that's launching on the 26th without having to go through all the I guess author journey that we've been talking about. So here's what I propose. How about we take the discussion so far and we push it into January for release.
Okay.
And then we meet again, perhaps next Tuesday. We can email to set the exact time, date, whatever.
Yeah.
And then have, we'll jump right in, introduce you. And then we can say that, you know, if you want to hear more about, Laura Nelson's journey, then tune in again on whatever date.
Yeah. I do tend to talk a lot. Two.
No, it's fine. And so do I. So I've actually been having several interviews recently where I've come out of it planning to split it into two episodes. But I don't have the time to jump right into the other discussion right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's cut it off right there. And,
okay.
And, then we'll really dive into the world building for the two subgenres and the contrast between them. We'll leave that for another day. Although for our listeners, they'll have already heard it.
Yeah.
So today is December 5th.
The first part will come later and the second part will come earlier.
Yeah. So today is December 5th. We'll push this discussion into January, maybe even February, because January is already mostly full. And then we'll talk again sometime in the next 2 weeks, and that will release on Christmas Day.
Okay. Yeah, that works.
But for the listeners who are listening to us today in January or February, where can listeners find you on the web?
So my website is www.llnelsonauthor.com, because that is my pen name, LL Nelson. I'm also on most of the main social media places, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, Threads, you name it. And I'm pretty much on all of those, LL Nelson Author.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I try to keep it simple.
Yeah. So then, just looking at my notes again, for listeners in January, she did have a book come out on the day after Christmas. So look her up and check out her new book. And well, I guess that's it. We'll catch you next time on the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. And thank you, Laura Nelson, for joining us today.
Yep.
All right, that's our interview section. It is January 11th right now as I'm recording this, and I'm pushing this out the same day. Got distracted yesterday. We all went to the county spelling bee where my 12-year-old got runner-up. So hoorah for her. I didn't push out the podcast. I didn't, you know, I can schedule it ahead of time. So I'm going to go ahead and push it out today. And also, you might have seen the beard disappear. If you watched last week's episode, I had a real beard going on, but I had to shave it for a picture. And I thought I'd try out the mustache, and it looks a little weird. I think I'll probably get rid of it too. But so what's going on right now? Nightshade Unicorn, the Kickstarter is currently ongoing. We hit funding level. We hit our funding level last week. So it will fund. And I'd encourage you to jump on to the Kickstarter campaign and reserve your copy. I'll share that link in the show notes, but something easy to remember, you can go to nightshadeunicorn.com and there's a link there that'll take you to it. There was something else I was going to mention, but that's going on. Oh, yeah. So since it hit funding level, we went ahead and started working on the song that we committed to recording if it funded. So I had previously, you know, obviously the lyrics to the song are in the book. I guess not obviously, but if you read the book, which you haven't, then you would know that. I pushed the book out to beta readers last weekend. So, yeah, I suppose it's possible that you're a beta reader. Few of you. I sent it out to 25, and I can see how many people have downloaded it, and it's over half. So, anyway, I'm talking over myself. I'll go ahead and wrap this up, but it's gone to beta readers. I had previously recorded myself just kind of playing the concept of a melody, and so this week I took that and I've now transcribed that melody onto the page, and next step I'm going to start harmonizing it and deciding what instruments to use, whether live or virtual instruments. I have, you know, many more virtual instruments at my disposal than I do live real instruments, but each one poses different challenges. But that's moving forward, and we'll see you next time on the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast.